by snipers and by drones, or by fighter jets. I don't know what to do with the knowledge coming from the TV set. I hear the woman speaking, and all that comes to mind is imagining the scene among the rubble I might find. If my family were in that building as it fell to the ground, and all the pieces of body parts that would then be found. Now I'm completely mad just from hearing the news day after day and being someone's dad. Just from hearing all the excuses about how it's justified, talking about the collateral damage, how all those babies died. Playing soccer in a field when the school day ends. Then I imagine the hospitals where the survivors go, their tiny bodies burnt and wrapped in gauze from head to toe. Each day I wake up and wonder if this might be the time when those who hold the purse strings have had enough of the war crimes. Then instead I'm hearing of the latest ones who have died in the unrelenting slaughter of Israel's kindercide. I turn on the news and I listen to the head of UNICEF say there are 35 kids in Gaza being killed.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, not every country in the Western Hemisphere supports the ongoing Holocaust in Palestine. In fact, some have faced to the same kinds of sanctions and blockades, coups and assassination attempts that make genocides possible. Venezuela is certainly one of those, but despite more than 20 years in the empire's crosshairs, it remains steadfastly defiant. More than this, though, the South American nation is actively rallying smaller countries to resist, as it has done in part by hosting the first anti-fascist youth and student world congress last month in Caracas. Victoria's Tyson Strandlin attended the Congress by invitation of the Venezuelan Foreign Affairs Ministry. Tyson's a Métis activist involved in a range of peace and solidarity struggles against fascism and more. He also serves as General Secretary to the Popular Democracy Movement, an organization he co-founded in Victoria earlier this year. Welcome back to the program, Tyson.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to speak with you and welcome home from your trip. We talked last in February during contentious events at UVic surrounding the ongoing war in Ukraine and groups on campus with opposing views of that conflict. You were with the Young Communist League at UVic then. You've since gone on to co-found the Popular Democracy Movement, as mentioned. Before getting to Venezuela, Tyson, who are and what is the Popular Democracy Movement?
Right. So the Popular Democracy Movement is a social, political, and cultural movement that has been founded largely out of what I think many of us who are involved will agree is an urgent necessity for a new political force, a progressive political force, to fill the vacuum that's been left by, well, again, a long history, in fact, of a lack of, I think, any sort of strong social movement offering progressive alternatives in this country. Certainly, we just saw the NDP, the Social Democrats here in BC, scrape by a thread in the recent election. I don't think they're going to pull that off again. I think that, you know, around the world and not just in Canada, but globally, we're seeing the rise of the far right, and we're seeing them tallying victories, which can be quite troubling. So I think what's needed is an organization that takes an approach to this that is able to win, is able to put to draw a line in the sand and to put a stop to that. I think that there is a desire for it amongst working class Canadians and regular Canadians who, you know, whose quality of lives, whose standards of living has been falling for a long time. There's a great urgency to this in terms of a number of things, in terms of the environmental crisis we're faced with, the rise of the far right, the drive to war, And that's what this organization is all about.
Well, the NDP took, they didn't really scrape through, not without an agreement for a minority government, the second in three tries by the party. What do you think about minority parties like it's the Greens in British Columbia in this instance, again, having the leverage, if they decide to use it, to sway to sway votes in the legislature and make the government perhaps fall? What about this idea where minority parties, small organizations, political outfits like the one you are currently a part of, have an inordinate amount of power given the unsettled political environment we're in this country? And we see it around the world, too, in the democracies.
Right. I a couple things here. I think it's useful in this case that the NDP is going to have to, negotiate and not just have sort of unbridled majority government power that I don't think really served the interests of working people over their previous term. I think that, again, most people living in Victoria who have lived through this, you know, skyrocketing costs and everything have not really felt the benefit of an NDP majority. So I don't see this as a bad thing that they're going to have to negotiate with the Greens. However, when we're talking about democracy as a concept more generally, I think that, you know, Canada is a country that is far less democratic than it often presents itself on the surface and would appear to be. And that's another reason that I think we need a different sort of political organization on the left to try and sort of counter this. I mean, what we have here is not a neutral state in which, you know, parties are, you know, vying with their ideas for who can achieve the best outcome. We have a capitalist state, right? We have a state that is very much, even the democratic, so-called democratic institutions and decisions that people make, well, they don't make them freely. They make them in a context where, you know, we've got a strongly controlled corporate media. We've got a very slanted and biased sort of democratic institution that favors existing big parties with lots of money behind them. And I think that, visiting places like Venezuela or Cuba or other places I've been, you can get an idea of alternatives and how things can be different. Canada absolutely needs to have some serious democratic reforms, and that has to be more than just in terms of the democratic institutions themselves. This has to be linked with economic reforms that take some of the power away from these big corporations. They have a wide range of formal and informal mechanisms to push their ideas, and I think we're seeing the very negative consequences of that, and we can expect to see more of it.
Well, there's never been a counterbalance in this country that I can remember, a true counterbalance to the power of the moneyed class and capitalism. And I don't know that it would be accepted, even if it was presented, accepted by Canadians. They have never really done that in the past. When you call yourself the Popular Democracy Movement, what do you mean by that? Is it inclusive? Is it popular enough to say that we're from the left, or that we are progressive, or to define oneself along an absolute spectrum like that? Does that not make it non-inclusive?
Well, I think you speak to an important point, and this is why we chose the name Popular Democracy, because what we're aiming for is precisely that. It's a democracy that is a people's democracy, in which, again, it's not ruled by the undue influence of these big corporate powers, and that's why it needs to involve, again, a fairly comprehensive set of reforms. However, at the same time, I think what we need is broad unity. And in order to have broad unity, you need to have a fairly simple set of unifying goals. You know, the Popular Democracy Movement has set out, for the time being, six sort of unifying principles that I think are generally fairly popular, and they're not really, in many ways, I don't think they should be considered as radical. They include, you know, tax reforms and making the rich in this country pay their fair share. They include democratic reforms, including things like getting rid of first past the post and replacing it with proportional representation. They include respect for the United Nations Charter, and rights of self-determination of nations, both inside and outside Canada. Includes things like, an end to fracking and a new environmental policy. These are things that I think most Canadians wouldn't really disagree with. And certainly it's been my experience in the past that they don't find those things too alarming.
Well, it's frustrating and for me, and I'm sure for a lot of, for many others, to value those elements that you just elucidated. And yet when they vote that way, for example, for the Green Party on environmental issues, all of a sudden the Green Party isn't there. They never moved the NDP, who had moved, had made those kinds of intimations themselves as regards fracking and other things too, in the case of the late John Horgan. But once in power, their impetus to move in that direction seems to disappear.
No, absolutely. You're right. And, you know, I think that's why we've also taken the approach that not just a political party, we need a new social movement, a new social culture, one that is more permeated throughout Canadian society and especially amongst youth and students. And I think that's something that we see a lot more in countries like Venezuela and throughout Latin America. They have, you know, a much more dynamic sort of culture. And you know, these political movements, they don't need to be exhausting. They don't need to be boring. It doesn't need to be simply going and, you know, having a rally and doing some chants and going home feeling worn out and burnt out and hopeless. I mean, like, I think we have a lot of nihilism and hopelessness in this country and in a lot of parts of the world, right? And it's easy to feel overwhelmed and that it's impossible to make these sorts of changes. But, you know, what we're witnessing around the world right now with the rise of the far right and the rise of fascism in various forms, and I include in that, you know, expressions like Zionism and neocolonialism and cyber fascism, this is not a sign of fascism or capitalism strength. This is not a sign of imperialism strength that they're resorting to ever more, you know, the drive to war. This is a sign of weakness, and this is an opportunity for a massive social change to take place. And I think that's something that was really reflected in the attitude and the unity of the many international delegates who were present in Caracas for the Congress this past month.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Tyson Strandlin. Tyson, as he just mentioned, is recently back from the Congress in Venezuela. It was the Anti-Fascist Youth and Student World Congress, the first ever held there. Tyson is a Métis activist. He's involved in a range of peace and solidarity struggles against fascism and more, and serves as general secretary, as we were just speaking about, to the Popular Democracy Movement, newly founded, co-founded by him. All right. Well, tell me, Tyson, then, how is it that you got this invite to begin with from the Venezuelan Foreign Affairs Department?
Yeah. More specifically, my invitation was sent to me by the youth wing of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela. I have a working relationship with them since 2019, when I was first invited to another Congress that took place, a Youth and Student Congress for Peace. And we've kept in touch ever since, along with many other international delegates. Like a lot of my work here in Canada, I just before leaving for Venezuela, I was teaching a community course out in Souk, a lifelong learning course about fascism. I think there's a lot of interest in it right now. People, for various reasons, are, you know, again, they're not blind to what's happening both in Canada and the United States and around the world, and the rise of far right ideas. And people want to understand that, people of all ages. And for me, that's something very encouraging. And the Venezuelans have taken notice of the work that we do here, and again, are aware of our goal and the importance in particular of having an anti-fascist, anti-war voice supported in Canada. Because, you know, the reason they had this international congress is because what's happening in terms of fascism and the drive to war, it's an international system that it's a part of. It's an international issue, and it needs to be addressed internationally, right? It's fascism is something that tries to divide people on all sorts of different lines by their country, their nationality, their race, their gender, anything and everything but class. The solution, the antidote to this toxic ideology lies first and foremost in international solidarity, friendship, and unity across borders.
Well, this focus on youth, Canada is not such a young country demographically. I think we're averaging over 50 anyway, as opposed to places like Venezuela. How does this appeal to youth for a movement work in that context?
Well, I think there's a couple things here. I think obviously the youth always have a certain revolutionary potential because youth have a particularly large stake in the future. You know, young people in Canada are faced with some very bleak looking futures on a number of fronts, you know, in terms of home ownership and the possibility of, you know, having meaningful work in their area of education, if they have an education, or just meaningful work at all, able to pay their bills, the groceries, the gas. Not only that, but again, this drive to war, you know, we're talking about increased spending in NATO, which has a long history of being this aggressive U.S.-led military bloc. Well, where does that come from? That's spending that could be used on all sorts of other, important social programs, including our healthcare, which is deteriorating, including public education, which is facing cuts, which includes, you know, good jobs and protective measures for our environment. So these are things that youth, whether or not they fully recognize it, have a very big stake in. And so, you know, I think a huge task for us here is to draw these connections between environmentalism and war, between economic insecurity and fascism and you know, these sort of right-wing politics that are coming to the forefront in a very dangerous way.
Well, when you go down there, Tyson, how is Canada and Canadians viewed by your fellow delegates from Venezuela and the many that came and joined this conference, more than 500 of them from across more than 70 different nations? How is Canada generally viewed?
Well, I mean, you know, Canada obviously is... we have a small population, but we're a big country. And not only that, we play an important role in the global imperialist system and in the NATO alliance, as I just mentioned. Canada played a very a leading role, in fact, in trying to destabilize Venezuela previously with the support for Juan Guaido, Canada's role in the Organization of American States. Canada has not played, at least the Canadian government, has not played a positive role in Latin American politics. You know, which is, I think, something that most Canadians are generally blissfully unaware of. That said, this position of Canada in the global imperialist system and in NATO makes delegates from Canada's youth who are there to show international solidarity and support and to build this unified movement, it makes their presence much more valued. And there's an appreciation for that. People from all over the world have struggles to share. And it's beneficial for all of us to share in those struggles, to learn from those struggles, what's been successful, what hasn't. We can't take a cookie cutter approach and apply solutions, you know, that work in one place, you know, directly, but we can still learn from them. And, you know, we have a particular task here to play in Canada in bringing about peace and stability. And I think, you know, having an anti-war voice about getting Canada out of NATO is a key part of that. That would be hugely helpful to so many people around the world.
Well, I think Venezuelans remember, but most Canadians probably are, as you say, blissfully unaware of this country's efforts to overthrow the legitimate government of Venezuela, the founding of the Lima Group back in 2017 or 18. Their efforts to overthrow the government after elections and to cast doubt on the legitimacy of democratic elections there. There was recently another election in Venezuela. And though the Lima Group itself seems to have fallen to pieces, Canada was standing there shoulder to shoulder with the United States once again, calling out Venezuela's election and saying that it was illegitimate and fomenting an uprising against the government there.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, the result was terroristic violence in the streets. There was a number of people who were murdered, including, you know, Chavista activists, violently murdered. You know, and I think Venezuela and many, many, many international observers, ranging from, journalists to representatives of all kinds of legal organizations who witnessed the electoral process and, witnessed its legitimacy, and took note, of course, that the opposition was already, declaring that the results would not be accepted if they were not in favor of their candidate, right? Like they're very aware that this this sort of violence is fascist in character, that it represents a small violent minority within the country, and anybody who's been to Venezuela can see that the socialist government, that the United Socialist Party of Venezuela and the project of the Bolivarian Revolution that was started by Hugo Chavez decades ago is one that has overwhelming support of a level unheard of in a country like Canada. It's absolutely palpable in the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who go out and march on the street, in a people who have an unparalleled level of political consciousness that they're able to articulate. You know, a government which is run by people who come from the poorest, come from the favelas, they're working class people, and they fight for working class people. You see a level of democracy in Venezuela that I think really is enviable. They don't just vote on government officials. They also vote, they recently had a series of elections about local projects to be carried out in Venezuela's communal system, a system which looks after all the people in their local communities, that makes sure children go to school with clothes. It makes sure that nobody in the community goes to bed without food. They know who is sick, who is vulnerable, who needs medicine brought to them. They even know whose cats and dogs are in the community that need something to eat. It's a remarkable thing to witness.
Well, what do you think, Tyson, is wrong with us here in Canada that we don't have a similar dedication to democracy? We speak it up to the moon, but when it comes to action, getting out to the polls is even too much for half of us.
Well, I think there is, again, this level of nihilism. I think there's any number of things we could point to as the causes for this. But I think there is, in fact, I think that the ideology of fascism, the philosophy of fascism and individualism is more deeply permeated in Canadian society than many people realize. And again, this is this sort of tendency towards hopelessness and nihilism is why we need to be fighting back against it with optimism, with unity, with a common cause and friendship, and with love. And not only that, but with joy. The people in Venezuela, the people in much of Latin America, going back to what I said earlier about the way so many of our manifestations of resistance, they can be rather exhausting. Well, we in the popular democracy movement believe in fighting with joy. Nicolas Maduro at the Congress, he made a statement. He said there's several tasks for the youth. First of all, we need to struggle. Yes, we need to struggle. Second, we need to study. Why? Fascism is the ideology which rejects truth. It is a revolt against truth. Our task is with truth. And for that, we're at an advantage. And thirdly, he said, rumba. We need to party. We need to celebrate. We need to celebrate life. Yes. That's something missing here.
Well, yeah, if you can't dance, then this revolution's not for me. Well, do you worry, though, that putting democracy in the title of the popular democracy movement might be a mistake, given what we see when we look at what's become of that concept in Georgia or in South Korea or even here in our neighbors south, when the elections don't go the way the powers want them? They just declare them illegitimate, as they did with Venezuela's election, in an effort to overthrow the popular will, or at least as much of it as can be expressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the terminology which we settle on is ultimately something that's always, under capitalism, they're going to try and co-opt it, no matter what it is. The most revolutionary slogan you can think of, they can bankroll it. And particularly in Venezuela, they're dealing with something called cyber fascism, which is, again, the use of this of social media as a new tool to try and cause massive dissension and confusion. And so, again, having clarity about the meaning of terms like democracy, along with a whole host of other things, you know, freedom is another one that's used so it's lost so much meaning. You hear it used in the United States all the time, and you hear it used by people on the right here. But, you know, what is that? We've got a difference here between freedom as an abstract idea and real substantive freedom, substantive rights and freedoms that can be practiced by regular people daily, right? I mean, I have the freedom, I guess, in theory, to own a helicopter, but it doesn't do me much good.
You also have the freedom to starve. We're fast running out of time, Tyson. The country, before we go, though, we're seeing this lurch to the right, an assault on the Charter of Rights in this country, in concert with what we see going on in Israel, I would argue. What's your reaction to Canada's position vis-a-vis the Israeli genocide going on in Palestine right now?
Yeah, that's an important question. And, you know, there were so many Palestinian delegates in Venezuela who were given a very prominent place and spoke with President Maduro. And then following that, of course, on the International Day of Solidarity with Palestine, Leila Khaled chose to go and celebrate that in Caracas with the president as well. But here in Canada, you know, we've got a lot of lip service to human rights, but it's a cynical thing that our government does. We have a sort of human rights imperialism where we only use terms about human rights in order to justify imperialist invasions and to justify war and regime change and sanctions and all of these absolutely unconscionable things which have nothing to do whatsoever with real human rights and the lives and dignity of people in countries across the global south and everywhere else. I think Canada should be ashamed of its role and its support for Israel. And I think that the struggle of the Palestinians is a struggle which everyone who cares about human rights, whether they are Arab, whether they are Muslim, whether they are anything else, whether they're on the left, if we care about the dignity and the struggle of humanity, we must be on side with Palestine, because what they are doing in Palestine, as I say, is reflective of a global system. And it is something that they will do anywhere and everywhere if they can get away with it. We must be in solidarity with the Palestinians, and they have my support to the hilt. One last thing I'll say is that on this note, we're hoping to hold an anti-fascist Congress ourselves here in May, in line with the anniversary of the victory over fascism in Europe. And I think it's one that needs to involve Palestinian solidarity activists. It needs to involve anti-fascists, anti-war activists, youth and students of all kinds. And that this broad unity is an important step forward for how we're going to resist.
Well, all right. And finally, it must be noted, December 9th, as I spoke to in the first half with Dorothea, is the International Day to commemorate and prevent genocide generally. And there's going to be activities in that in support of Palestine. Finally, Tyson, how do people find out more about what you guys are doing and hope to do over there at Popular Democracy?
Yeah, but right now we've got an Instagram where you can contact us, Popular Democracy Movement, easy enough to remember. Our website is under construction at the moment, but it'll be released soon. You can also send us an email at popular.democracy.movement@protonmail.com.
Well, thanks a lot, Tyson, for coming on and talking to me a little bit about it today, and welcome home.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to also thank, as I said, Dorothea Gucciardo over there at glia.org. That's GLIA.org. Go there to find out how you can help. Thanks again. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time.
Each day I wake up and wonder if this might be the time when those who hold the purse strings have had enough of the war crimes. Then instead I'm hearing of the latest ones who have died in the unrelenting slaughter of Israel's kindercide. I turn on the news and I listen to the head of UNICEF say there are 35 kids in Gaza being killed.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people. His bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.